Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Flourish Together's Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. I'm Rana, one of the directors of Flourish Together CIC. We're an organisation that helps women changemakers like you to flourish.
And I'm Michaela Talkington, one of the co-founders and directors of Flourish Together. I'm currently in shock that we've made it to episode 9 already. How did that happen? For this podcast, we thought it was important to talk money, funding and being resilient, as there are lots of opportunities around at the moment, and we wanted to help people get some tips and inspiration from women changemakers, as well as funders and supporters of social enterprise. In this podcast, I was keen to show the human side of funders and hear how they've been adapting and responding to the pandemic, as well as bring some of the tips and information we've put together in our toolkit called Flourishing Beyond COVID to life. As part of our Flourish Talk section, a range of women across our networks will share tips and insights on grants, investment and resources they've secured in the last few months. But first, we'll hear from Iyabo Fahinlateem, consultant clinical psychologist and director at Just Psychology, who talks to us about the highs and lows of resourcing your social enterprise.
Just tell me a potted history of Just Psychology and what social issues you're addressing.
I mean, we work with children and families, so it's psychological health and emotional well-being, children and families and communities, but we focus on cultural competence and social justice and cultural diversity. We're working with a wide range of children and families across Greater Manchester. Some of that is in terms of early intervention and preventative services, children with issues with anxiety, low mood, behavioural problems, that kind of thing. We do a lot of work on that in Trafford. So we engage with a lot of families and offer group work, individual work and workshops that parents from all across Trafford can just drop into. They don't have to, you know, make appointments and go through all those different kinds of barriers. And we also do a lot of work with children and families on the edge of children's social care, maybe at risk of becoming looked after. So we work with the social workers and the family members to identify the family's strengths and get the families to collaborate, work together so that they can keep the child at home and within their community safely. We do training for a lot of other organisations on cultural competence and cultural awareness. That's a lot of what we do.
Wow, that's so much. Now, you've been part of Flourish for a long time.
Years, yeah.
And you had a little bit of backing from them. You were already established when you came along to Flourish. And I know that you went for investment. How did you know that you were ready for investment? Tell me about that process.
How did you know we were ready? I didn't, is the quick answer. I thought it wasn't for us. It just sounded like something for a much bigger organisation and that we were way too small. I was introduced to someone. She put me in touch with First Arc, and I met with somebody from the Reach Fund, Paula. And again, I just thought it wasn't really for us, but what's the harm in having a meeting and a chat to find out more? And it was really Paula who kind of convinced me that, yeah, this is something that could work for us. But it still felt like quite a challenge to think about taking on that amount of a loan. And, you know, being confident that we could pay it back. So we got all the kind of help with becoming investment ready through the Reach Fund, and that was really good.
What sort of stuff did that involve?
Business plan, financial forecast, that kind of thing. So they gave us a grant to get some extra support to get those things in place and to look at our social impact forecast and our financial forecast. So that's what really, I guess, gave me the confidence that, yeah, this looks like it could be possible. And then we were delighted to get the offer of the investment, but still quite cautious because taking on debt is not something you do really easily. But then as a board, we looked at the terms and conditions and decided that actually this is something that we could probably, you know, so no one knows the future. You can't tell what's going on. Who would have predicted COVID, for heaven's sake? So you've no idea what's going to happen next year, but given all the information we had at that time, the best evidence that we had was that we could take on this investment and repay the loan. It was a mixed investment, so it was a grant and a loan.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes, I think the grant is a certain percentage of the total amount.
Was it a good experience?
I think it was a good experience. It was but very supported in sort of putting in the applications. And it kind of built my confidence as well, because, you know, they came back and said the Social Investment Board were really pleased with it, really happy with it. And you're thinking, really? So, yeah, it kind of gives you a bit more confidence that maybe you do know what you're doing, and things a group of people think about investing and they're prepared to do it, then it does massively increase your confidence, think, you know, that you're making a difference, and that for totally independent people, they can see the difference and appreciate the difference that you're making.
I think as social enterprises or charities or not-for-profit organisations, the idea of investment, like you were saying before, seems a bit scary, like, oh, I've got to pay money back. How does it differ from grant funding then?
Well, grant funding, you don't, you just get it and you deliver what you said you'd deliver, and you don't have to pay anything back. So they can stop the grant and decide not to pay you anything more. But I think unless you've done something absolutely horrific, they're not asking you for anything back. So it feels like a bit more of a gamble, because you don't know exactly how the future is going to pan out. I think for me and for the board, it felt like a big step to take that on. But I remember speaking to a friend who's in business. So he works in a private business, and, you know, I was trying to get advice from people about, you know, does this sound like a reasonable thing to do? Or I remember discussing it with him and going through the terms and conditions, you know, just generally, not in detail. And his response was, what's not to like? What's your problem? And I just realised, from a business point of view, this was really good. But, you know, he couldn't see what on earth we were getting ourselves all worked up about. So,
do you think you'd be where you are today without the investment?
I think it would have been difficult for us to grow to the extent that we have done, because it enabled us to bring in more support for the services that we deliver, and to have people around with expertise and knowledge about, you know, how we could shape the services and engage with funders and engage with commissioners. So, you know, it's helped with all those things.
So the investment sounded like a really positive experience. What's been the highs and lows of resourcing Just Psychology over the years?
Yeah. When I first started, I mean, I've learned so much in the time that I've run Just Psychology, because I didn't train as a social entrepreneur. I trained as a clinical psychologist. There's nothing business related in that whatsoever. And I think for me, getting my head around financials has been a major, major challenge. And I remember when I was first starting off, I remember being in some group or something where someone said that, was it turnover is vanity and profit is sanity? And I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. I just thought, what is that? You know, that's something that's nothing to do with me. But over the years, I've realised it's one of the wisest things I've heard anyone say. Lots of turnover and everything going brilliantly. Like, you know, in that sense, you're doing loads of work, but unless you are actually getting, you know, some kind of profit, or unless you've got an eye on the profit, the margins, whatever you want to call it, then you're going nowhere. And they say cash flow is one of the biggest problems for businesses. I can absolutely see that and appreciate that. That taught me a lot about things like pricing. It took a few years to get my head around that, but just realising that you can't just give things away if you haven't got funding for it. And that's why I started off doing, really doing lots of things, because, you know, because I could and because we could. But then you don't have money to pay staff, you know, don't have money for admin or computers or things like that if you work that way. Yeah, that's been one of the biggest challenges.
Has it got easier to finance what you're doing?
I wouldn't say it's got easier. I suppose for me personally, in terms of having any kind of qualms about it or worries about it, that's easier, because you know, I don't even think about it now. I just have a list of how much this costs and that's it. And if someone says they can't afford it, they can't afford it. Whereas a few years ago, I would have tried to bring it down or think of something off the top of my head, just go with how I was feeling at the time. So in that sense, it's easier. But in terms of what's available out there, I just think that, you know, times just change. You know, things are up and down. I think the track record we've got is incredibly helpful. And so when we bid for contracts or funding, they can see that we've delivered other things, that we're a safe place in a sense. At the beginning, I tried writing bids myself. And after, I don't know how long, 2 or 3 years, I completely stopped because, well, more or less stopped, unless it was a very low value bid. Because I realised that, you know, yes, I can write psychological reports, I can write journal articles, book chapters, all those sorts of things, but what I'm not good at is writing bids. And so we have a bid writer, a lovely woman called Melanie, who writes more or less all our bids. That's something I've learned over the years, is if you want something doing properly, get an expert in to do it. And yes, it costs, obviously you've got to pay them, but it's worth it.
So the organisation has a blended income approach. So you've got grant funding, you've just had the you've got core funding from Reaching Communities.
Yeah, well, that's for a project.
You had investment, you take on contracts.
So, and we do spot purchases. So some local authorities will approach us and say, we've got this family that, you know, needs some help that we think your service could deliver. Will you be able to do that? And it might just be a one-off, we don't have an ongoing contract with them, so we do that as well.
Have you had to make changes because of COVID in terms of adaptations to your services and what you offer?
It's all online now. That's been a huge adaptation because everything was face-to-face and now it's all completely online. So we're still learning, I think, like many other organisations, about the pros and cons of that, the impact on staff of being in one place at home and, you know, being on Zoom all day and got lots of meetings. I think there's a very different impact of the work and a very different impact on staff who are delivering work in that way. So that's been the biggest change for us.
Have you found any opportunities?
I think what we're thinking of going forward is that what we need to do is to look at when face-to-face is better and when online is better. So there are some real benefits of doing things online. So, for example, in terms of our board meetings, people who normally can't make it have been able to attend the meetings, regardless of where they are in the world, whether they're abroad or whether they're, you know, at the other end of the country. So that's been a massive bonus, because before this, they would have just missed the meeting. And we've been able to offer more things in, you know, later in the day, in the evenings, to families. Whereas before, you know, that would have been tricky because they would have had a lot to juggle to come out to wherever we were delivering. We're kind of just looking at the pros and cons. What will we keep going? Will we maybe in future just have some of our services delivered online so that they're more accessible to certain groups of people? But then there are some people that are struggling to engage online. So families with children with autistic spectrum conditions, for example, or ADHD, it's much harder to engage those children in an online session. There's a place for both online and face-to-face, so we're just trying to work out as we go along what the pros and cons are and what the future might look like.
As is everybody, isn't it? We're all in the same blooming boat, aren't we? When did you start this organisation?
2011.
Wow. So what advice would you give fellow women who are looking to start a social enterprise and are just perplexed by the whole making money side of things?
I think getting involved in networks that are out there, so finding out what other people are doing and what's going on, but also, where possible, getting onto some kind of training course. Mm-hmm. You know, because I did right at the beginning, or fairly close to the beginning, I did something called the Knowledge Action Network at MMU, and I found that incredibly useful, even though it seemed to be more focused on businesses, not social enterprises. I think that's the other thing I would say to people, is don't just stick within the charity social enterprise sector. Have a look in the business sector, because there are real things that you can learn from that. And there isn't a kind of very clear divide between one and the other. And then I also did the School for Social Entrepreneurs.
Did you?
Really, really, really good. So learning from other people is incredibly helpful, because, well, for a start, you know that you're not alone struggling with these things, but also you can learn from their successes and their mistakes. I think that would always be my advice, is to just find out what's going on out there, network. Get onto courses. I think particularly getting onto courses, because that networking, it's a form of networking, but it's structured, and it's really helpful.
Well, thank you so much for spending a little time with me today. I know you are totally, totally busy, and yeah. I think we've got some really good tips there, and it's really helped chilled me out actually about running my social enterprise and getting investment as well. So thank you very much.
Oh no, it's good to meet you. Thank you. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Vic and Iyabo. Great to hear how resourceful Iyabo has been during this challenging time. Let's hear now from our funder and support panel to see how the land lies from the other side of the fence.
We've got a treat now, as everybody perhaps who's listened to this knows, it feels like a bit of a crazy time for applying for grants and funding and support. There's a lot out there. There's a lot that's been paused. There's a bit of confusion around at the moment, different things. We have produced our Flourishing Beyond COVID toolkit to try and help people navigate some of this stuff. And there's some other really great resources out there. But we thought, why not bring the agencies and the funders to you in this episode and just show them for the human beings that they really are? Because I know it can get quite frustrating for people when they're filling in forms or they're filling in online applications and they think, oh, you know, am I just another number? And, you know, there are real people behind the scenes who are lobbying, trying to shape support opportunities and making decisions on, you know, sometimes quite difficult decisions on grant applications and investment applications out there. So we were keen to not just hear from women change makers that we work with, but other colleagues that we link with up and down the land. So I'm really pleased to say that we've got three fantastic women working in the sector on the call and on this podcast. I've got an old colleague of mine, or current colleague of mine, Alex Phillips. She's one of the social enterprise support managers at Unlimited, covering parts of the North and Midlands. Unlimited, for anyone that doesn't know, is a national charity that finds, funds and supports social entrepreneurs. And they're really trying to support enterprising people with solutions that change society or their communities for the better. So great to have Alex with us. We've also got Lucy Finlay, who we're really pleased to have, from Social Enterprise Mark. They are an award-winning international social enterprise accreditation authority. And they're really all about making sure that the awareness of social enterprises and real credibility of social enterprises is brought to the fore, and basically dedicated to supporting social enterprises up and down the land and around the globe now. Lucy will tell us more there. And last but not least, we were keen to have some local perspective. So we've got Alison Crush, who is part of the team at GMCVO, that's Greater Manchester Council for Voluntary Organisations, and she's working on their investment team. So really pleased to have you all with us, ladies. I was just going to start off by saying, you know, asking each of you in turn, really, how things have been for you during the current pandemic. Perhaps I'll come to you first, Alex. How?
So the award winners that I've been working with, I think at first were in a little bit of shock. We're kind of going through a period of maybe like almost like grief. You know, they perhaps accessed some other funding and that had been cancelled because of the situation. Quite a lot of the early work was around kind of establishing what was going on. A lot of our award winners, particularly the early stage ones, are at that really key time of it's a little bit risky if they stop now, but they've got no option to stop because a lot of the work that they do is out in the community, face-to-face work. A lot of the conversations I had was simply about the well-being of those people, and then it moved on maybe a couple of weeks later to the practical, right, what am I going to do? What money can I access to make this happen? It really turned around into quite a lot of positivity, because I think social entrepreneurs on the whole are really positive lot.
Absolutely. Well, we'll come back to perhaps some examples on that shortly, Alex, but I was just going to come to Alison for your point of view. Obviously, Alex works predominantly with a lot of early stage startups, quite risky, as she said, probably, you know, falling between the cracks of a lot of some of the support, some of the grants available at the moment, but ploughing on regardless. I know you work with slightly more established ventures that are seeking social investment. Perhaps tell us from your point of view, how things been, and is it business as usual? Have you had to adapt in any ways to support people?
Yeah, it's kind of business as usual in as much as it can be. Everyone's working at home at GMCVO. So we're supporting our existing investees with our Access to Growth programme, and we're trying to have conversations with them as much as we can so that we can understand the situations and how we might be able to help them. We were able to offer them all a 6-month repayment holiday to sort of ease the load on the investments that they had taken up.
Sounds pretty generous in many ways that, you know, some people haven't got that on their mortgage, have they?
Well, luckily, we were able to do it through our funders. They supported us to do that. So that has been a real help.
And have you seen new applications coming in?
Yes. We're still running the social investment programme. So it's for to help organisations be more resilient and to strengthen their social impact in Greater Manchester, but also now to help them recover from the pandemic. So as Alex said about trying to help organisations to pivot their organisation, so we're able to offer existing investees a grant to change their business model to adjust.
Fantastic. Just coming to you, Lucy, because obviously Social Enterprise Mark isn't a funding agency, but it's a real key organisation in helping lobby, helping influence. What have you seen, perhaps some of the pressure points for the voluntary community and ultimately social enterprise sector right now?
At first, it was like trying to find out, well, what is it that we really need to be doing to make sure that we are COVID-proof ourselves as a social enterprise, and how do we need to treat our customers, and what will our customers be experiencing? So we spent quite a lot of time thinking about how we would best do that. And we reached out to our partners in the national arena to say, can we come together to be more effective in helping to support social enterprises at this time, because there are various major national bodies. And fairly quickly, we realised that it needed something more than just a voluntary community sector approach. We did need a specialised approach for social enterprises. So we all came together and we thought, well, actually, what we're seeing coming from the government is, on the one hand, there's a lot of mainstream business support, but that really doesn't seem to be pitched particularly towards social enterprise, although we want it to be. And then on the other hand, there were some fairly big voices coming from the charity sector, which weren't really covering the social enterprise agenda either. So what we did was we came up with a manifesto of different asks around funding, loans, and also business support, which we all agreed and we signed off fairly quickly, and used that as a means of getting everybody to sign up to it. And to date, we've been successful collectively in getting an additional £85 million into the sector. Now, I've been particularly responsible for the banking sector, which has been very interesting, because not only are we trying to support social enterprises to have specialist funding, but also to turn the mainstream banking sector more towards being able to understand what social enterprises are doing. So I've spent a lot of time brokering support for social enterprises to mainstream banks and ensuring that they get, amongst other things, their share of bounce back loans, which have been aimed at businesses.
Certainly in our toolkit, we've tried to highlight a lot of the government schemes that initially people might write off as not relevant for them. No, you make some great points there, and well done on getting that additional investment through. I know I was a bit of a cynic, as I often am with these things, thinking, oh God, here we go. What's the signature on a letter going to do? But, you know, I think it was quite motivating to see that actually come together and see that the different partners involved in that. So thank you. I was just going to come to Alex and then perhaps Alison, just on any observations from your side on any other pressure points in the sector right now as you see it.
Pressure points, I mean, the ones that we've noticed in our investees are managing their cash flow is the biggest thing, being able to meet their immediate costs. So we are accepting application from investees who need support with their cash flow, as well as supporting our existing ones. And the things that having to deal with are sort of increased health and hygiene standards and having to protect themselves and anyone involved in their organisation, looking at whether there's obviously any physical changes needed to their space. But obviously a lot of people in the voluntary community social enterprise sector are dealing directly with people as well. So it's trying to bring in those separations, but still having that personal contact, which is so important to people when they need the support even more now.
Yeah, so organisationally, we've actually paused our award programme, so we haven't been giving out new awards at the moment, and that's a strategic decision to make sure that we can support our existing award winners, because I think we understand that making new awards at this time of such uncertainty, I think it's a little bit risky for us and for the award winners as well. So what we have done is been looking at where those gaps are. You mentioned before about people kind of falling between the cracks, and providing a little bit of extra opportunity to those current award winners to apply for additional funding, to enable them to either pivot or look at more long term. You know, if their business model is now obsolete, what can they do to still be able to work with their beneficiaries? So it has been about helping those that have not quite been operating for long enough to access some of the government grants that have been available, but those who might have just been starting to get enough traction and they're at that really frustrating point where, you know, perhaps they've got a building and they've been renting it out and that's been providing some stable income and they can't do that anymore. So looking at how we might be able to provide a little bit of extra top-up funding to just enable them to keep going, because they know what they want to do when things get back to whatever the new normal is, but they're not able to do that this time, and they've still got outgoings that they can't really afford to pay because their income streams have dried up for now.
Yeah, I know we've seen quite a mix when we were putting the toolkit together. You know, there's quite a number of organisations, funders that have paused or done things differently, and then there's another load who are still operating business as normal, and it's quite sort of, I guess, confusing for the wider public to know who's doing what, and it's a case of just, you know, a case-by-case basis having a look at what funders are doing what. But I wonder if you've got any examples of social ventures who you've been observing. Well, I'll come to each of you, but perhaps starting with Lucy, examples of great social ventures that have been stepping up, you know, and leading, you know, leading in a really positive way.
Yeah, well, there's a very famous example which has just got quite a high profile, which I've been asked to come onto the board of, which is the Big Issue, because of course the moment lockdown happened, then they could no longer sell the magazine on the streets. So they had to completely change their business model and move to a model which meant that, you know, you could buy the magazine online and you could buy it, I get it delivered every week now. Then they were encouraging other organisations to take out subscriptions. So that money would then go into a new, a reformed charity, Big Issue Investment Trust, of which I'm now a trustee, which would then look after that money and ensure that it went to the street sellers. And also gave loans to those sellers to help them buy equipment and that kind of thing that they needed to have during the lockdown and ensure the sustainability of the social enterprise going forward. So that's been quite an interesting case study. I immediately spoke to some of our more digitally led social enterprises, so Cosmic, based not too far from us here in Devon, and although they were a digital organisation, they were providing a lot of their training face to face, and they had to pivot and completely change models to providing absolutely everything online. As a result of that, cut their mileage by 60,000 miles. 20 tons of CO2 has been saved from the environment, and also of course that's cut their costs as well. And I think they found that their clients have now realized that they can access a lot of these services digitally that perhaps they hadn't before, and their eyes have been opened because they've had to be.
Yeah, no, you make a really good point there. I know from Flourish's point of view, when we've done research in the last few years, because obviously we work with a lot of women and not all women can get to the events or the things that we do. We've been asked for years to do more online and we've just not had the capacity, or we thought we didn't. Lockdown has certainly proved to us, you know, we've been creating more podcasts than we've done before. We've moved all our events online. We can now do these sort of listen again versions, so that if people miss the workshop, we've now got a YouTube channel with all these listen again seminars that are going to be relevant for a number of years to come, you know. So it's been a real eye-opener for us.
I think because we're a national organisation as well, well, international organisation, people always assume that we're based in London. And I used to spend a lot of time trying to jump on a train, you know, to get to meetings and things. And of course, now everybody is meeting virtually. So actually, we have become far more accessible and others have become far more accessible. And I found it's been less London centric as well.
It's a good point, that, for sure. And I've been in sat in conferences and Zoom calls in the last 2 weeks I can think of where there's been people from Nigeria, Switzerland, Australia, South America, you know, it's
exactly
has changed things somewhat there. But I was just going to come to you, Alison, if I may, and just see, we were talking before about examples of some great social ventures that have been stepping up,
yeah,
leading, you know, positive change.
Yeah, I mean, we received quite a few through GMCVA, through our networks, and from some of our investees as well. The ones I wanted to mention were the Hidden Treasure Discovery Centre, which is a CIC over in Partington. And they've set up a community response hub. So since the lockdown in March, they've turned their Hideaway Centre, which was a supportive centre for the local community, into a community response hub. So they're working closely with Trafford Council, Trafford Housing Trust, Partington Food Bank, and many other organisations in the area. And they're hosting things like local food bank, running errands for isolated residents, doing Meals on Wheels, and delivering essential items to people. So we've heard a few stories of people doing things like that.
Yeah, that the level of collaboration that's happened, sort of local to global, has been really interesting. Alex, I was just going to come to you. I'm sure there's a plethora of, you know, social entrepreneurs that Unlimited are supporting. Have you got any in particular to mention who've stepped up?
Yeah, well, I think what Alison said really resonates with the experience of what's happening with our Unlimited award winners. I think food and looking out for people locally seems to be a really quick way in which our social entrepreneurs have developed their ventures. So I won't name them, but we've got three social entrepreneurs across the Northwest who they've either got community spaces that have now become a hub for distribution of food. We've got a social entrepreneur in Rochdale who was doing cookery classes, who and they're now looking at they're delivering meals, cooking meals, and delivering out them out into the community. What an interesting one. We've also got a boxing club. Obviously, they've had to close, but they've been using some of the boxers to kind of go out and do mentoring. So they've been working with young people who are at risk of being excluded from schools, and they're obviously quite vulnerable, and they're out in the community and at home, and they're looking at going on to quite quickly now do some outdoor smaller classes so that they can get back to it. So there's some really interesting stuff going on.
Good. I mean, I guess one of my bugbears a while ago, and don't get me wrong, grants are needed, and we will always support people to look at a grants route, and they are there at the moment to help people. But I do wonder whether we're sort of regressing some way, and I just wonder, you know, how are we going to support, you know, innovation, and how are we going to support, you know, trading, do you think, sort of going forward?
I think it was quite interesting at the beginning of lockdown, there were lots of people that were going around saying, well, we've been encouraged by the government and we've been down this track of becoming more trading focused. And now the rug's been pulled from under our feet. You know, it's up to the government to kind of sort this out. And there was quite a lot of angst, I think, at the beginning of it. But I think now, from what I've seen, people are beginning, that they became much more creative, you know, following on from getting quite angry about it. And actually, what will come out, I think, will be probably some more robust ideas about how a social enterprise can trade. But it's by no means a panacea, because, you know, we were looking at particularly those that were working with disabled people who just can't pivot. You know, they do need support going forward from the government until it's safe for them to come out back into the main world again.
Yeah, I was just thinking that there probably need to be sort of more partnership working and maybe mergers between organisations so that people can't afford to work in isolation really so much anymore. I think that's always been the case, but more so now people need to work together to be more resilient. And because of the high unemployment levels, there's likely to be more enterprises setting up, and so greater need for sort of development support for those organisations. And there's going to be a change in the kind of needs that are arising. So people are going to adapt to that, I think, aren't they? But obviously also more sort of planned strategic move towards working remotely. Like you said before, we're doing more things online. And I think a lot of that is going to stay as well. It can be more inclusive, but it can also make it harder for some people to get involved. So we need that balance as well, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, as a sector, we need to be as encouraging as we can. But I think we need to, there's a bit of a reality check in there. You know, there's going to be a recession afterwards, and we don't really know what the landscape is afterwards. So I think it's about being flexible and looking at those opportunities. You know, I'm just thinking in the areas that I work in, is there an opportunity for the social enterprise sector to have better connections with the corporate businesses in the local area and things like that? Like, how can we do things differently? How can we share the resources that are available?
Yeah, and I know there seems to have been a bit of a shift really in terms of people's recognition of what the voluntary community and social enterprise sector does. You know, I think there's a long way to go, but you know, having seen this groundswell of voluntary activity, but also recognizing that the hundreds and thousands of organizations already established and set up who've been able to step up in ways that perhaps your high streets or your more sort of hard-nosed commercial businesses can't or won't. I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, on whether, you know, the reputation of the social enterprise world and the, you know, the voluntary sector is going to be changed in light of, you know, the social leadership and the strength of leadership that people have been able to show.
I really do hope so, just because the social enterprise and voluntary sector have been able to really step up quickly and deal with this situation, you know, set up new, not businesses, but new activities within a matter of weeks. And I think if that recognition just, if it's just a race back to get to how things always are, I think that would be really disappointing, because it's not capitalising on those opportunities. You know, you've got people who've got real local knowledge that can just step up really quickly and with very little resource. So why would you not celebrate that and support it going forwards?
I think, you know, a bit like what Alex was saying, we don't want it to go back to business as usual. The advantage of social entrepreneurs is that they are entrepreneurial. What I've been very encouraged by is just the way in which people have been so quick to look at ways in which they can generate income and the ways in which they can adjust at this particular time. So I suppose the challenge is going to be for those social enterprises at the moment that are in, I would kind of say, in hibernation, if you like. So those that most of their staff are furloughed. So there's a bit of uncertainty there. But I think that, you know, the fact that quite a lot of social enterprises have been looking at ways in which they can generate income despite, you know, downturn in other parts of the trading area has meant that they will survive. But whether they will survive to be quite the same is a moot point, really.
Wait to see, yeah. But I think the point Alison made before around social enterprises being a really great space for training, employability, people getting new career pathways, mm-hmm. I think, you know, hopefully that there's a lot of potential opportunity there. And we certainly know of lots of examples of how community businesses and social enterprises have been helping regenerate high streets and regenerate deprived areas. Previous austerity, you know, if that's only going to be compounded, then let's hope that, you know, wider leaders, business leaders and public sector leaders have a look at some of these innovative ways that communities have been trying to break through from poverty and break through from cycles of, you know, inequality for some time and use those models.
Yeah, that is the point that we've been making to government collectively as the, you know, the alliance that was lobbying on behalf of social enterprises. We've kind of moved out of the, you know, save our social enterprise mode. And now we're making the case to say, look, social enterprises are really good and have a track record in helping address some of these really bad unemployment issues. So, you know, if you want a business that is really going to help address some of the, you know, deep-rooted problems in deprived areas, then social enterprise is the answer to that.
Good. Well, we shall keep flying the flag. I think we're almost ready to perhaps wrap up our panel discussion here, but because part of the theme for today is around show me the money and helping people think through how best to approach their next either fundraising or bid writing or commissioning activity, I wonder whether, you know, off the top of your head, any what your top tips might be for, you know, for people who are making approaches to funding agencies or support agencies right now.
I would say get in touch so that we can have a discussion, because if our investment program isn't appropriate, but we might be aware of other ones that would suit people's needs.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say get in touch, because I think the pre-application stage is really important. But also, at this time, we're really interested in stuff that's different. So we're looking at things that we can see might be future-proof, even though we don't quite know what the future is yet. So it's definitely worth having a conversation, because what might have seemed like something that was a little bit out there, I think we really need to listen to those kind of innovative new ideas.
Yes, if organisations are thinking of going for loan funding, we have been doing a piece of work on trying to iron out the problems around that. And we're about to hopefully launch a survey to find out why people aren't accessing the loan funding. Sometimes it can be because the loan provider, you know, the bank manager or whatever, doesn't understand the social enterprise business structure, or doesn't understand that it's a business. So let me know if you have those problems, because we're doing a piece of work with UK Finance to try and help the social enterprise sector better interface with the mainstream banks and let them know what the problems are.
I think that, as Alex has been saying, right now it's a case of getting a reality check on, you know, the level of austerity and recession that we're going to be in, and really thinking about how social ventures and the support agencies and the funders that are out there to help them really do start to think and work differently and lead the way, hopefully, in the months and years to come, as it's going to take, I think, to get through this. But thank you all for your time and your thoughts and for sharing examples and things there. I really appreciate it.
All of our panellists there spoke candidly about what they are seeing and shared some great examples of social enterprises stepping up during the pandemic. Although it's clearly challenging time right now to navigate the lay of the land with so many funds changed and paused, so hopefully this podcast will give some comfort to people looking at their options right now.
Absolutely. To help with this, we recently published a one-stop toolkit with support from Manchester City Council. It's got over 100 links to funding and support. And people can find this by searching hashtag flourishingbeyondcovid on Twitter, or you can visit our Knowledge Hub section of our website. Let's now hear from some of our network who've been securing local and national funds recently to get some inspiration and hear how they've gone about it.
Hello, I'm Claire Courtney. I'm one of the co-founders and directors of Heart and Parcel. Heart and Parcel is a Manchester-based community project, and we bring migrant women from different communities around Manchester to practice English together. Over the past 2 months, we've been really, really lucky to receive a grant from the We Love Manchester charity. It was their COVID-19 Community Response Fund. And from that, they were able to source enough money for us to transfer all of our cooking and English classes online. So we're able to live stream to all of our original learners of the project, but also to reach lots of new learners. Top tips for funding. I would say make sure that you do your research about the charity or the organization that you're trying to get money from. Make sure you look at what they're looking for, what they fund, and also the previous projects they've funded. Make sure your project is clear and concise and gets straight to the point, states all the main things that you need to say pretty much straight away. Finally, get someone to have a look through it. Firstly, to check if it makes sense to them, if it's something that they can understand, but also to catch any kind of last minute errors or spelling mistakes and things. Good luck.
Hi, my name is Karen Howarth from Brain Health Breakthrough CIC. We're a training organisation that deliver high quality training to different groups within the community. At the moment, we're delivering training for people with brain injury experience, unpaid carers, and we're also delivering some volunteer training for an organisation that delivers kind of support for people who are self-isolating at the moment. My top tip in applying for funding is to be proactive. You know, I applied in March, April, right at the start of the lockdown. We already had a bid in to run events that were face-to-face, so I contacted the Awards for All and spoke to them about withdrawing that application and putting in a new one. I spoke to Nicola at Flourish GIC. I spoke to other people to get advice, and all I did is I retweaked our current application to look at how I could deliver what we were delivering online instead of face to face. And in speaking to the Awards for All, they really liked the fact that we were delivering training for volunteers and working with more vulnerable groups within the community.
Hi, this is Kimberly Bond from Visit from the Stork CIC. We're a social enterprise in Salford mainly and in Manchester, delivering lots of services for parents to ensure they can give their children the best quality of life. During COVID, we've started doing a project where we've delivered baby essentials to vulnerable families in hardship, asylum seekers, single parents, people who've lost their job. Obviously, COVID has affected a lot of people, and we felt this was a really, really important project to start. And we were lucky enough to get some funding. So we've received funding from We Love Manchester and Forever Manchester. We've received donations from various different businesses, which has been absolutely fantastic over the few months, because people have really, really wanted to get involved and help with our cause. The tip that I would say to be able to get funding is to really look at the guidance around what it is the funders are expecting, because you can tell your story all you like, but if it's not what the funders think would fit with their priorities, then unfortunately you won't get funded. And it has happened to me a few times that we haven't been funded because they felt it doesn't quite fit into their priorities. So have a look around different funders' priorities. It's normally in their guidance, and you can really see what they think their outcome should be, and you can really mention those keywords in your application. And if you do that well, coupled with a story or a case study from a client that you would like to help, that you think that's what their situation is, then you'd have a good chance at getting most of the funding. For example, the Big Lottery always likes being community led. So if you can give examples of how what the need is in your community. My community said this, and I know this through a survey, or I know this through feedback from these clients or these referral agencies. And you really have to think about how your project can prove that it does that.
My name is Yvonne Edukereili. I'm a founder of a social enterprise called Sour Barbecue, as well as a founder of a charity called Dynamic Support of Greater Manchester. In the last 3 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit the globe, we noticed the shortage of our cash flow in Sour Barbecue. The dream to grow Sour Barbecue suddenly stopped because of the big investment we did, such as booking event pitches well in advance. We paused all our recreation professional activities within our charity. However, despite the hard time that we all went through, I did not let my team down. We are first a charity before being a social enterprise. Therefore, our aim is to promote the health and well-being of the disadvantaged women, girls in the Greater Manchester, fight against poverty. I did not give up and I applied to Food Response Team Fund at Manchester City Council for a sum of £500 to survive and help buying food and grocery to make food parcel instead of staying there without doing anything to our members as well as the rest of the community. This wasn't straightforward. We have encountered few barriers such as lack of trust from the funders. They thought that we were unable to provide the service. Finally, the first food grant was paid into dynamic account and I immediately start making food parcel with the food response team at Manchester City Council. Then I received a phone call from GMBME Network who was checking to find out how as a BME organization we were coping during the pandemic. I did not hide my anger and I told them that we have our beneficiary, demand is increasing, who are expecting help from us. But I feel sad that we don't have any money to support them. And they advised me on some funding application like Forever Manchester to apply to, which I did. And luckily, we received another funding to help enhance our work. I opted since then to apply only for small grants, which are easy to receive and quick feedback from funders. From April to 2020 until today, we have managed to raise some small food grants such as Food Grants Manchester City Council, One Manchester, We Love Manchester, Forever Manchester, Tesco Bag of Help, GM Walking Charity Service, GM Wellbeing. We have helped so far a total number of 456 households. My team and I are proud of what we have achieved during this pandemic. And what I have learned is to be resilient and never give up no matter what happened. Never let people's judgment put you down as a woman-led enterprise. Thank you.
Always inspiring as ever, and what a range of opportunities they've gone for. This is never as easy as some of our changemakers have described, and on top of running their ventures, it can be a real challenge fitting this in. So well done for getting stuck in to develop the resilience and recovery of your organisations to maximise community impact in this difficult time.
Yes, thanks everyone. And as usual, all the links to the organisations are in the show notes, along with access to the toolkit that we've put together.
That's it for this month's Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. And if you're loving what you're hearing and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do leave us a review.
Or if you're listening elsewhere, do share your thoughts and ideas on social media and tag us in. Like Emma Kavoinen from Social Research Partnership, who commented on enjoying last month's episode and has gained a lot from attending some of our recent webinars. You can also find out more about us and what we do or drop us a line the old-fashioned way over at flourishtogether.org.uk. So having hit our 9th episode milestone, we're planning on taking a little break, rain or shine, over the summer, and we hope to be back in our podcasting saddle in the autumn. So we'll see you on the other side.
Supporting Women in Social Enterprise is a Mike Media production and is produced and edited by Vic Elizabeth Turnbull.